Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The politics of the global economy is a carefully choreographed thing. So even though Chinese President Hu Jintao doesn't actually arrive in Washington until next week, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner started doing the dance this morning. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Yellow Book 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com. And by Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 12th of January. Glad you could be with us. There will be much pomp and circumstance next week when Hu Jintao does arrive in Washington. But the real business of these kinds of visits doesn't actually wait until the guest is in town. In a speech this morning, Timothy Geithner mapped out what he calls the path ahead for the U.S.-China economic relationship. First, he repeated what we've heard before from both Congress and the White House, lawmakers of both parties. He wants Beijing to stop undervaluing its currency. But Geithner also covered other, perhaps more important ways to level the playing field. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Tim Geithner previewed President Obama's pitch, let more U.S. companies in and stop stealing intellectual property.
Our priorities in this economic relationship, from the exchange rate to the protection of intellectual property, reflect changes that are fundamentally in China's interest.
China is concerned about its lack of homegrown innovation, and more competition could spark that.
Ultimately, China will need to make these changes in order to promote its long-term prosperity.
Geithner said U.S. exports to China are growing at twice the rate of U.S. exports to the rest of the world, and he wants that number to rise. Scott Kennedy teaches at Indiana University. He says the message is, what's good for us is good for China.
You need to take this medicine, but it's good medicine, and it'll be better for your economy in terms of improving intellectual property rights, corporate governance, reducing market barriers in several sectors.
But UC Irvine professor Peter Navarro says that won't be easy for the Chinese, especially when it comes to swiping intellectual property.
It provides anywhere from 10 to 30%, depending on the estimate, of the GDP of that country. So it's not going away anytime soon.
In fact, Navarro says the Chinese think that they can innovate by demanding that companies with factories in China fund more R&D right there, while China still makes it tough for foreign firms to compete for contracts. Above all, Geithner wants an end to what he calls the government domination of industry there. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Moving on to industry here, you could say that Borders wrote the book on book superstores. It pioneered the concept back in the early 1970s. Now, though, the chain is writing a new chapter in its history, one that could be its last. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
Borders was the first bookstore to actually encourage loitering. Mark Freeman's a retail consultant with Focus Management Group. He says at the time, it was unheard of to offer comfy reading chairs and cafes so shoppers could hang out.
It was brilliant. Their stores did huge volume. It seemed like they could do nothing wrong.
Borders also created many loyal customers who came of age in its stores. One of them is 20-year-old Stephanie Sears of Wayne, New Jersey. She even started a Save Borders Facebook page.
My family would go there often. My dad used to call it like Sunday nights at the bookstore, so it would be kind of like a weekly thing.
Other stores like Barnes & Noble copied the Borders model, but then the business changed. Discounters like Walmart and online bookseller Amazon undercut prices. Tablets spurred online book sales, and Borders failed to evolve. In the past few years, it closed hundreds of stores. Freeman, with Focus Management, says Borders still has too many stores, and they're too big.
Right now, the country is overstored with those stores, and I think the new model for the way business is being done today is a smaller store.
Meantime, the chain can't pay its bills and is trying to renegotiate contracts with landlords and publishers. Borders insists it has not hired a bankruptcy lawyer. Freeman says if Borders goes under, the entire book publishing industry loses. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
When the manufacturing conglomerate ITT was founded back in 1920, the initials stood for International Telephone and Telegraph. The company eventually grew into one of the world's biggest firms. It did everything from heavy industry to baking bread to running hotels. ITT sold off the telephone and telegraph part of its business a while ago. It's been streamlining since the 1990s. And today, ITT announced plans to split itself into three separate companies because it seems big is not necessarily better. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
More than one business writer referred to ITT today as the ever-shrinking conglomerate. But don't write the whole idea off just yet.
Conglomerates aren't dead. Not all of them.
At the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, business professor Larry Rabiniak says witness Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, which continues to do well with a vast collection of businesses.
If we run a portfolio, like a portfolio of stocks, and as long as we just buy good companies, and if they're making money, the conglomerate does okay. You know, it's a pooling of profits. Basically, it comes down to that. If they're profitable, the conglomerate looks good.
In other cases, the idea behind the conglomerate has been sharing executive know-how and finding overlapping efficiencies between businesses. That's something known in the corporate world as synergy. From media to banking giants, though, those synergies haven't always panned out. Ed Lawler is a business professor at the University of Southern California's Marshall School.
It calls for, in some ways, unnatural behavior in the sense that you're saying to executives, managers, technical people, it's not enough to just think about your area. You've got to think about and be aware of and coordinate with what's going on in these other areas.
In those cases, Lawler says it can make sense to let corporate managers pay specific attention to their particular businesses, especially when tough economic conditions and keener competition call for a sharper focus. Today, analysts were focusing on one of the biggest names in conglomerates, suggesting anew that General Electric might benefit from just this kind of streamlining. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Okay, today's reminder that this is a global economy. Wall Street was up in part on news of a successful sale of Portuguese government bonds. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Boy, there are some red faces in the Idaho legislature today. A group of lawmakers was getting a presentation on some new education software, and a whole bunch of them flunked a pop quiz on state history, like when Idaho became a state. Commentator Robert Reich says that's exactly what he's been saying.
In a recent survey of 34 advanced countries, American students came in 25th in math, 17th in science, and 14th in reading. President Obama calls this a Sputnik moment, referring to the wake-up call we had in the 1950s with the Soviet successful launch. The result then was billions of dollars to make sure our children didn't fall behind. In subsequent decades, big business pushed for additional education spending to make sure we didn't fall behind in the global competitive race. But now we're going in the opposite direction. The tax bill signed by the president in the closing hours of the last Congress widened the budget deficit, inviting cuts in public education. Pell grants for disadvantaged young people to attend college are already squeezed. Less visible are cuts the states are making. Starved for revenues, 33 states are slicing school budgets, meaning more kids to a classroom and fewer courses. And 43 states are reducing funding for public universities. Many qualified young people won't be able to attend. Now, I'm not one of those who believes the only way to fix what's wrong with American education is to throw more money at it. Teacher performance also has to be squarely on the table, and bad teachers let go. But given the increasing population of young people and their educational needs, and the new competitive challenge of skilled workers all over the world, more resources are surely needed. So why are we allowing these big cutbacks? Partly, I think, because America's biggest corporations are no longer pushing for school funding. Increasingly, they're getting the talent they need all over the world. Many now have research and development centers in Europe and China. Meanwhile, America's well-off families have enough money to send their kids to good private schools and to pay high tuitions at private universities. But without the political support of big companies and the well-off, public education has become vulnerable, which means less investment in our nation's most important asset, our kids.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His most recent book is called Aftershock, the next economy, and America's future. David Frum is up in the commenting rotation next week. Send us your comments whenever you like. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says contact. As we sit here in the early days of 2011, we have the entire internet at our fingertips. We can stream full-length movies to the wireless device of our choosing. We can sit at home in the living room and point and click and shop for almost anything we want. And yet, when we run down to the corner store for a quick errand, when it comes time to pay, we have to whip out the actual plastic. Credit card companies make more than $50 billion a year from the transaction fees they charge merchants when we use our cards, online or in person. And that's a lot of money. So some big-name technology firms, from Google to AT&T, would love to get a slice of it. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Millions of Americans use the personal finance website, Mint.com, to create budgets and manage their money. Aaron Patzer invented it. In 2 years, he built the site into a $170 million business. But there's one aspect of managing his money that Aaron says is still a royal pain in the, well, you know.
I'm sitting here uncomfortably in this interview with a big chunky wallet in my pocket.
It's 2011. Google's built a self-driving car. New freezers can send text messages to your cell phone if the meat's going bad. And Patzer wonders why the old-fashioned wallet still exists.
There's no reason that you need to carry around as many cards as you do just to have the information that's on a magnetic stripe. If you could do it in a very secure way, you could eliminate all of that. It'd be a much more comfortable world to live in.
Lots of us are already halfway there. We have smartphones. And think, if you started paying with your phone, it could automatically warn you when you're going to overdraw. It could tell you what card to use, even guide you to the best deals on soap. And all this technology already exists. A few weeks ago, I walked into the Cheeky Monkey, a toy store in Menlo Park, California. I needed party favors for my 7-year-old's birthday, and I was in a hurry.
So this is our tub of erasers. We leave them kind of all mixed together because the kids like to go on the treasure hunt.
Okay.
When it was my turn to pay, I reached for my phone. It has a little sticker on the back, and that sticker, made by a company called Bling Nation, has a chip in it that can basically replace my bank card.
Just tap it onto the little machine here, and then it automatically comes out of your account.
Startups like Bling and Isis, which was founded by the nation's biggest wireless carriers, are gunning for the credit card companies. Visa and MasterCard charge merchants fees every time any customer swipes their plastic, and each year they make billions this way. The startup's plan is to undercut the big guys by charging merchants less in swipe fees, and they'll use chips on your cell phone or inside it to replace your plastic. Before any of these systems will work, though, stores will have to equip their cash registers with new gadgets that can read the chips. Jeffrey Mullins runs Dynamics, Inc., another startup that wants to digitize your wallet.
It would cost hundreds of billions of dollars to change the magnetic stripe infrastructure in the United States and re-educate the merchants that use it.
In the meantime, Mullins is taking a different approach. Instead of trying to build a credit card into your phone, he's building tiny computers inside traditional plastic cards. One smart card from Dynamics lets you choose among your different accounts, or...
For the loyalty-oriented consumer, Citi just announced the Prestige 2G card, which has two buttons. One button to pay for your purchase with credit, and for the first time ever, now you have the ability to pay for your purchase at the point of sale, at your gas stations, at your Apple stores, with your reward points.
And no matter what technology takes off, whether it's computerized credit cards or smartphones that can pay your tab, chances are it will be intelligent enough to steer you away from high credit card fees.
That's the problem we want to be solving. How do I get something in my phone that says, don't use this card, use this other card?
Omar Green runs mobile strategy at Intuit, the company that bought Mint.
There are potentials for us creating really, really smart systems that are smarter about your money than you are.
That potential hasn't been realized yet. Back at the Cheeky Monkey, after waiting and waiting for my charges to clear on my phone.
Why don't I go ahead and pay with a old-fashioned plastic card?
Or maybe I could even use cash. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Coming up, the bonus battle of Britain.
I think the chances of there being a cap on the pay of CEOs are somewhere between slim and none. And Slim's just left town.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow advanced 83 points today, almost 0.75%, finished the day at 11,755. The NASDAQ up 20.75%, 2737 at the bell. The S&P 500 added 11 points, nearly 1%, wrapped up at 1285. Financial stocks deposited some impressive gains today. Citigroup led the way, ringing up nearly 3%. Both JPMorgan Chase and Morgan Stanley cashed in 2.5% higher. Bank of America and Wells Fargo rolled ahead around 2% apiece. A healthy bond auction in Portugal, as we mentioned, gave investors more confidence in riskier bets. That moved them away from U.S. Treasuries. So here's the bond number for today. Lower bond prices pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 3.37%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud. By Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com. And by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for December. The Commerce Department reports on international trade for November. And a McDreamy birthday. Patrick Dempsey turns 45. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. A year ago today, almost 250,000 people were killed in the Haitian earthquake. Government and society there are still trying to recover. In pure financial terms, though, losses were about $8 billion. That's a lot anywhere. It's almost inconceivable in the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. But Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports that what Haiti needs now, even more than aid, might be trade.
The economic calamity caused by the earthquake has not been quite as bad as expected. Pamela Cox is with the World Bank.
We had originally projected that their production would fall some 8.5%, that the economy would contract. Now, the good news is the economy contracted only 7%, but that's still a contraction in a very poor country.
The World Bank and other international organizations helped to finance some public-private partnerships. Other companies have lent their expertise. Olga Reyes is a spokesperson for Coca-Cola's Latin business unit.
We didn't want to stop at shipping water or tents or money. We wanted to do something that could help build the country back and build it better.
Agriculture is one of the primary sources of jobs in Haiti, and mangoes are one of the main crops. Most of the fruit is sold by street vendors.
Mango, mango. You have mango? $10.
But Reyes says farmers could improve their standard of living by exporting their crops.
Our goal is to double the income of 25,000 Haitian mango farmers over 5 years.
Perhaps the biggest potential for Haiti's economy lies in its garment industry. To help boost trade, the U.S. Congress relaxed quotas on Haitian garments. Charles Reese is with the Clinton Bush Haiti Fund.
Haitians will have this special advantage in exporting T-shirts and pajamas and those kinds of goods to the U.S.
That special advantage attracted a South Korean clothing maker to Haiti. Yesterday, it signed a deal expected to create 20,000 jobs. At the event, Haiti's prime minister called the occasion the happiest day of his life. He pointed to the deal as a step towards breaking Haiti's dependence on foreign aid. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
It's Wednesday, that time of week to hear what you have to say.
I'm going to send right back.
down and write myself a letter.
I talked to ProPublica reporter Jesse Eisinger a couple of days ago about how Standard & Poor's is still having problems getting their credit ratings right. Toxic bonds that got those AAA ratings were part of what led to the whole financial collapse, as you'll remember. Alexander Rahman of Raleigh, North Carolina, thinks we let the bond rating agencies off way too easy.
You guys missed the point of the possibility of collusion between the issuing agencies and the credit grading agencies. The impact that this has had on the world economy deserves more than, see, the credit agents didn't even understand it. They should all be indicted for fraud, collusion, and conspiracy and held accountable.
The American Economic Association convened last week for its annual meeting. There was some talk about, but no firm vote, on an economist's code of ethics. Annie Lowry from Slate pointed us towards some research showing economists tend to make more selfish choices, which prompted this from Zoe Plakius, a graduate student in economics at the University of California, Davis.
He did not acknowledge the possibility that all economists study some game theory, and thus they know the theoretical outcome of the game and strategize accordingly.
So they know the points of the games, and that changes how they play. But Zoe also doesn't buy the argument that economists shouldn't really write about groups that give them money.
Much economic research is funded through grants, and some of these grants come from industries or government entities. This does not mean that economists were somehow bribed.
We got a lot of enthusiastic responses after a commentary by Marissa Mayer from Google last week. She proudly defended being a girl geek. Lori Johnson of Little Rock, Arkansas, is a self-proclaimed nerd as well. But she says there is another point to be made here.
Our puzzlement over the whole, oh my God, girl thing. It's the guy geeks that seem to make a lot of fuss over it. We don't. We're women. So what? Get over it, guys. We have problems to solve.
You can geek out over our show anytime. We're not going to judge you, I promise. Send us your thoughts and find links to follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org. The British government has a marketing plan for its new austerity budget. The tagline is, "We're all in this together," this being the budget cuts and service reductions and general economic hardship. The economic pain is probably being felt equally at the lower ends of the income distribution. Britain's bankers and company bosses, though, are another story. Last year, the country's top 100 CEOs saw their pay jump by more than 55%. Most workers, meanwhile, got a measly hike of just 2%. And so now the less well-heeled are fighting back. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Geraint Anderson is a reformed addict, a reformed bonus addict.
My first bonus was $20,000. Next year, it was $80,000. And within 10 years, I was on $750,000.
And still it wasn't enough. Geraint, a former bank analyst, says an ever larger bonus is the ultimate mark of distinction in London's financial district known as the City.
If I am earning twice what John over there earned in bonus, it literally means I'm twice as clever, as hardworking. And of course, that mentality drives people to do whatever is necessary to increase their bonus, any form of deceit and nastiness that can be imagined.
Like insider trading or spreading false stories, Geraint repented his greedy, amoral way of life. He quit the bank and wrote a best-selling expose, City Boy, Beer and Loathing in the Square Mile. And he penned this little ditty, lampooning the excesses of the city.
Another hard day, number crunching, then I'm off to lunch. I'm munching Russian caviar, smoking big fat cigars.
Meanwhile, Deborah Hargreaves is taking steps to end what she calls Britain's culture of excessive pay.
We need to look at this huge gap between rich and poor and a huge pay differential between top and bottom.
Deborah heads the new High Pay Commission, a private body which aims to dream up ways of restraining top people's pay. Deborah says when times are hard, like now, everyone should share in the austerity.
When the economy's going well and things are booming, I don't think people begrudge it as much as they do when they see bankers and top execs running off with huge rewards, millions and millions of pounds, when the rest of us are struggling to make ends meet.
Britain's top 100 CEOs earned at least $8 million each last year. That's 200 times what the average worker earned. And then there was this.
We are extremely sorry. There's a profound and unqualified apology.
We are profoundly, and I think I would say unreservedly, sorry.
The tabloids called them this sorry lot, a clutch of bankers who grovelled before a parliamentary committee, having run some of the country's biggest banks into the ground. Within weeks of their apology, though, they were all riding high. One with a new annual salary of $3 million, another retired on a pension worth $12 million.
You've got to call time on it and say enough is enough. We've seen this take off in an arms race for pay over the past 10 years. And I think unless someone says that's it, where will it end?
The High Pay Commission will consider a range of possible curbs. For example, a law limiting executive pay to no more than 20 times the average wage paid within their companies. This does not go down well with free market advocates. Richard Wellings of the Institute for Economic Affairs.
It really isn't the business of, say, politicians and bureaucrats to start interfering and determining pay by committee. We don't want to head in that direction.
And even the reformed bonus addict Geraint Anderson, who now rails against the bonus culture, doesn't believe a British government will ever try to put a lid on executive pay.
I think the chances of there being a cap on the pay of CEOs are somewhere between slim and none. And Slim's just left town.
But the new High Pay Commission is pressing on and will deliver its recommendations before the end of this year. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, helping small businesses and nonprofits make sense of social media. You can learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. By the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at chevyvolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt, it's more car than electric. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today about the Fed's beige book, something that, honestly, we ordinarily only mention when we've got some extra time to kill. But the Fed's regional report on the state of the American economy that came out today was remarkable for its uniformity. For the first time in I don't know how long, any good news the beige book has had to offer in one part of the country was tempered by weakness in one or more other parts. But not today. The Fed reports economic growth everywhere. It's weak, but it's growing. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow climbed 83 points, almost 0.75%. The NASDAQ bounced 20 points higher, 0.75%. The S&P 500 added 11 points, nearly 1%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on The Big Show, the short answer to why there was a housing bubble and bust.
You were getting flippers buying from other flippers. That had to stop. What happened to the American dream of just buying a home to live in?
Lot 354, a tale of America's housing meltdown. It's a Marketplace special report with public television station KCET here in Los Angeles. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.